It's time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Thank you very much for tuning in. A beautiful day today. We're broadcasting live as we do each and every year from the fabulous Tunbridge World's Fair. A little bit of a chilly morning here, a little bit of a breeze. You may hear some breeze in our microphones throughout the course of the morning here, but don't let that distract you. We are going to have a discussion that will start in just a few moments here. We're going to be having the first debate here of the political season between the leading candidates in the race for lieutenant governor. Many observers say this will be the most interesting race in a political season where, unfortunately, there really are some offices that are going somewhat unchallenged, and so we'll be featuring debates throughout the political season here. Coming up in just a few moments, we're going to introduce you to Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott and his challenger, Dean Corin. We're not able to take your phone calls throughout the debate this morning. I encourage you to stick around for our discussion this morning. We're broadcasting live here at the Northfield Savings Bank Broadcast Gazebo. And we're going to be broadcasting our simulcast here on WDEV AM and FM. Our friends at 93.9 at WLVB in Morrisville, which serves the communities of northern Vermont, they will be joining us coming up in just a few moments. I want to tell you about one of our great sponsors on the program. Our friends at Jet Service Envelope have been a longtime sponsor of the Mark Johnson Show, and we greatly appreciate it. And we greatly appreciate those that you have gone and used their great services. They are a local printer located in South Barry. But one of the beautiful things about printing in 2014, all you need to do is send those items over to them electronically, and they even do delivery, so you may not even ever need to go there. And you can reach the folks at Jet Service Envelope, find about the many services they provide at 229-9335. That's 229-9335, and you'll find them on the World Wide Web at jetservice-envelope.com. Let me just tell you a little bit about the candidates before we kick off our debate this morning. Phil Scott is the current lieutenant governor. In 2000, he was elected to the Vermont State Senate, representing Washington County for five terms, and then he followed that, elected as lieutenant governor back in 2010. He is born in Barry, educated at Spalding High School and at the University of Vermont, and he is a co-owner at Du Bois Construction. Dean Corin is a progressive from Burlington. He will also be appearing on the ballot as a Democrat. Dean is served as a member of the House of Representatives, served four terms, elected in 1992, serving up until 2000. And he is also served on the Burlington Electric Commission, graduate of Middlebury College, trustee of Vermont Public Interest Research Group for 16 years, and also works for an innovative power company, a company that uses underwater hydropower systems. So we're going to welcome our candidates here. We'll kick off our debate and our discussion here with them in just a moment. And a reminder, too, that coming up tomorrow at 11 o'clock here, right at the gazebo here at the Tunbridge World's Fair, we will be broadcasting a debate with the leading gubernatorial candidates. So we encourage you to stop on down for our discussion on that. And again, we're broadcasting live this morning from the Tunbridge World's Fair. We are here at the gazebo, which is in the north end of the fairgrounds, and you're welcome to scoot on down and observe the debate. We're going to take a short commercial break. When we come back, we'll kick off our discussion, our Lieutenant Governor debate with Dean Corin and Phil Scott. We'll be back right after these important announcements.
It's official. All Smiles Family Dental Center is Central Vermont's Invisalign preferred provider. To celebrate, we're offering Invisalign for the same price as traditional braces. Affordable financing programs are available. There is no reason not to get the fantastic smile you deserve with comfortable, clear, virtually invisible Invisalign aligners. Now for the same price as braces. Call 476-8700. That's 476-8700 to arrange a free initial consultation. Or visit mybtsmiles.com. All smiles on the Barry Montpelier Road. Are you all smiles?
All smiles, all smiles.
Todd Stone from G-Stone Motors.
And I'm Travis.
Hey, you know what I was thinking, Todd?
Oh boy, what now?
Well, look at this amazing lineup of Ford vehicles. Styling, fuel economy, power, they have it all.
Yeah, but GMC does too. They have great new styling, and the new Sierra is really classy.
Oh, really? Ford's been the number one selling truck for over 40 years. Top that.
The all-new GMC Sierra was just voted number one best buy, but I don't know why we're arguing about this.
Good question. We have both GMC and Ford here on our lot, and that's a huge time saver for our customers.
Customers can come and look at our huge inventory of new Fords, GMCs, and great lineup of pre-owned used vehicles.
Whether it's fuel economy, durability, or luxury that you're looking for, we have what you need.
And remember, we take anything in trade. View our full inventory online at gstonemotors.com, and don't forget to like us on Facebook.
Also, don't forget our sister store, G-Stone Commercial, for all of your truck, trailer, and equipment needs. Service, parts, sales, and rentals, they do it all.
G-Stone Motors, your hometown Ford and GMC dealer where they take anything in trade. Route 7 in Middlebury or online at gstonemotors.com.
Thinking about doing some projects on your home? A home improvement loan from Granite Hills Credit Union is the answer. It's quick and easy. Borrow up to $10,000 with this personal loan at a great fixed low rate. No appraisal or title search required. Remodel your kitchen, replace your roof, or add a room. You decide. Looking to do a larger project? We have home equity loans with new lower rates or a line of credit that allows the flexibility of check writing. Give us a call, stop in, or visit us at granitehills.org to find out how you can make your remodeling dreams come true.
Granite Hills Credit Union is an equal housing lender and is federally insured by the NCUA.
Here this morning. I have a series of questions for the candidates. I'll start actually with a question that's an individual question for each candidate. And then I've got a series of questions that I've gotten from our listeners as well as some of my own. And I'm not going to put a strict time limit on you folks. I'm going to ask you to please honor each other here. And if I think you're going too long, I'm not going to hesitate to interrupt. Lieutenant Governor Scott, thanks for joining us this morning. How are you?
Good morning, Mark. Very well.
Let me start with a question for you this morning. Your reputation, Phil, is one as being a nice guy. Is that something that you consider to be a something that you carry with pride, or would you rather be known as a politician who feels passionately about an issue, in favor of an issue, or as a passionate defender of an issue? Because I think many people don't see an issue clearly identified with you.
I don't think you have to have one or the other, Mark. I think you can have both. When you're characterized as a nice guy, I think that's part of the respect, part of the heritage of being a Vermonter. I've carried that proudly throughout my whole life, being born in Vermont. We have a sense of tolerance, I believe. and respectful of other views. And but I'm, you know, I have my core principles. I have issues that I'm very passionate about, and maybe I don't show them as much as some people do. I don't get up on a soapbox and scream to the world about what excites me. But as people that surround me, the people that known me throughout my career, whether it's in racing or business or my political life, I stick to my guns after listening to all sides, and then I move forward, and I try and do so in a collaborative manner, consensus building, trying to build a team so that we all get what we need and prosper in Vermont.
Tell me an issue you feel passionately about.
I feel very passionate about the environment in terms of keeping the traditions of Vermont, the heritage of our agriculture, and so forth. That's something that's very is good for Vermont, but also the economy, and the two tie together in so many different ways. As I've traveled throughout Vermont, what I'm finding from many people, the common theme has been the crisis we face is the one of affordability, that there are folks that they're struggling to working two and three jobs, trying to make ends meet, not talking anymore about paying their mortgages. They're talking about, how do I pay my property taxes? How do I survive? How do I put fuel in my fuel tank? And that's becoming more of a crisis as we move forward. So I think that putting that on the front burner, as I've said so many times, that we need collectively, collaboratively, to all get on the same page and put that as a priority as we move forward in the next couple of years.
Dee, thanks for joining us this morning. How are you?
Great. Thank you, Mark.
I wanted to ask you about your seeking the Democratic nomination. I've known you for a long time as a pretty hardcore progressive. In fact, there was a period of time when the Progressive Party had bylaws which didn't even allow a progressive to accept another nomination. So I'm wondering about your evolution over time here in seeking the Democratic nomination. And is this just an opportunistic way for you to try to win this election and not really believing in what the Democrats believe?
Well, Mark, as you know, as you may know, I was a Democrat before I was a progressive. And when I was involved with the Progressive Coalition, which it was for many years before it was a party, we tried to create a lot of change in the city of Burlington, and I think it was very positive, both economically and socially, and encouraged Democrats to do the same. And what you've seen over the last several years, in the 90s, I worked very extensively with Democrats in the legislature, along with Republicans also. When you're part of a tiny party, you have to collaborate with a lot of people in order to get anything done. And over the years, I think the Democratic Party and the people of Vermont in general have come to a great degree of agreement with progressive principles. And so when you see the governor and others talking about the issues that will really help Vermonters survive economically and prosper, you're talking about the same kind of principles that we've been working for all along. And so I feel very close to what the Democratic Party is working for now in Vermont and have for some years. I'm very proud as a Vermonter to see what the Democratic majority has done in the legislature to push issues, even like GMO labeling, a simple right to know for Vermont consumers that was pushed primarily by progressives and Democrats together. So those kind of collaborations, I think, are going to be really helpful to move Vermont in the direction that Vermonters really want to go. And the primary health care issue right now is what Vermonters want, Vermonters need, and really addresses the affordability of living in Vermont, getting that health care issue done. And that's what our number one area of collaboration is going to be.
When Peter Clavel, who was the mayor of Burlington, was a progressive and ran as a Democrat for governor, was that my recollection is that was not something that you were terribly high on?
No, actually, I was very supportive of that. In fact, I've supported many Democratic candidates throughout this entire, many decades, including a couple of Democratic lieutenant governor candidates. So I have a very strong record of supporting many Democrats, including Peter Schoen.
The Senate President John Campbell says that you've been bashing Democrats. Can you respond to that?
Yeah, you know, I mentioned this in talking to the Democratic State Committee that one person had written not too long ago, even, that Bernie Sanders had made a career out of bashing Democrats. And the fact of the matter is that all Vermonters and Democrats know that Bernie Sanders made a career out of fighting for working people, for seniors, for veterans, and for women's rights and issues like that. That's what he's made a career out of. And as someone who's worked for Bernie Sanders, I have a very similar approach in terms of being focused on the issues, what people really want and need, and getting those carried out. If I ever criticize the Democratic Party, that was for, you know, good reason, perhaps, but that has never been the core of anything I've worked on. It's really all about the issues, and I think there's a great degree of alignment now.
Phil, why is the Republican Party in Vermont seem to be struggling so much?
Well, I think that over the years, obviously, I think that we've suffered from a national perception. There are many, many throughout the country that would disagree with the approach that many Republicans have taken. Some of the social issues have been first and foremost on many on the national level minds. And you know, I look back at the core of Vermont Republicanism. You look at Calvin Coolidge to start with, but then you go to Aiken, Stafford, Jeffords, many really powerful Republicans that were different. You know, Vermont Republicans are different than the national Republicans, and I think we lost that a bit along the way, and I think that we should refocus and look back, move backwards almost in some respects, to redefine those traditions and what's really important to Vermont.
How would you respond to that, Dean?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question. I mentioned to the Democratic State Committee that the party of Aiken and Dean Davis is gone. And it's really a shame. Obviously, I don't think we can move backwards. We need to move forwards in a number of ways. And the Republican Party that used to exist in the, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s in Vermont really did move us forward. But it doesn't exist anymore. And it's really not about party. It's about getting the job done. You know, I went up to Franklin County Field Days. We've been going to all the fairs around the state. I walked into the fair, and the first thing that happened was that a Republican state rep walked up to me and grabbed my hand and said, "How are we going to get health care done? My people want health care." And that's what Vermonters want, and we're going to work with Democrats and Republicans who are willing to do that to get the job done. And that, you know, I'm motivated and passionate about running this race because I think we need a lieutenant governor who's going to work on getting the details done, go around Vermont, talk to people, and explain it, and not merely be skeptical. We've been looking at this for 30 years. We've known it's been a crisis since it really kicked in as a crisis starting in 1990. That's when the acceleration in prices really started to take off.
Okay, we'll get to health care.
All right.
Let me ask you about the Progressive Party. Why has the Progressive Party not taken off the way you might have hoped and expected?
Well, actually, I think it has. I think if you look at the history of the way things grow, they start very, very slowly, and then they take off more quickly. The Progressive Party has consistently grown since, you know, it didn't really start until, like, 1999, 2000, when the party was actually formed. And we started with two state reps, and then now, you know, we're moving up to five and six and a couple of senators, yes, in combination with the Democratic Party. It, you know, that is a slow but significant growth rate. In fact, it's the only successful third party in the entire nation by that standard. I would expect it to continue to grow. And at the same time, as I pointed out to the Democrats, the Democratic Party has grown tremendously also. And it's simply because we're talking about the issues that Vermonters care about and need. And when their pocketbooks are being harmed, it's by issues like health care.
If you're just tuning in, we're broadcasting live today from the Tunbridge World's Fair. We're having a debate between the lieutenant governor candidates. Well, let's talk a little bit about health care. First question I want to ask on this and have you both respond is, should health care be tied to employment? Phil?
Well, it has been traditionally, but I'm not necessarily thinking that it should in the future. Obviously, Vermonters want, when I go across Vermont, what I'm hearing, there's a lot of confusion about Health Connect, the Health Exchange, single payer. They don't really understand the differences between all the different topics that we've been talking about. But what they do want is they want to be taken care of. They want health insurance. They want that comfort of having something, so that when they're sick and they need to be taken care of, that they have something to lean on. So I think our approach is interesting. I think the health exchange that has been developed, the Health Connect, well, it's been a disastrous rollout and is fraught with problems at this point in time. I think having the exchange makes some sense, and I think that we should be putting our efforts into trying to make sure that works. And maybe expand it in some ways. I've talked a lot about in terms of maybe forming an alliance with New Hampshire or Maine, tri-state or bi-state relationship, so we can build our numbers, so that we can have some competition and have the exchange actually work.
Can you respond to that question? Should health insurance be tied to employment?
Well, certainly it should not be tied to employment. It's an accident of history after World War II, when it was a relatively cheap benefit that could be provided by employers. And in most countries, of course, most developed countries, it's entirely separate from employment. That particular question about employment is very interesting, because once we do separate it entirely and we have our own healthcare plan, which is simply based on being a Vermonter, it's automatic that we're all covered under the same plan, then people will be free, our economy will be free. First of all, the burden of dealing with healthcare every year, trying to figure out what plan to offer employees, will be lifted. And that tremendous overhead cost will be lifted from our businesses, so they can be free to concentrate on their actual work. And then from the employee point of view, people will be free to do the work that they're best suited to, that they're most passionate about. They'll be free to start businesses. That's where our new job growth is going to come from. It's not going to be persuading, you know, large businesses to move into Vermont. And that freedom that Vermonters will get, not have to be worried constantly about what will happen. Are they going to end up in bankruptcy because of a major health care bill? And can they switch a job because it's better suited to them, or it's a shorter commute and they're not trapped? Those are huge benefits that don't even come into the money that we're going to save from going to our own single-payer or self-insurance plan for the state of Vermont. Now, the important thing is that the lieutenant governor can have a critical role to play in all of this, which is to talk to Vermonters, explain how simple single-payer is compared to the complexity of the Affordable Care Act, the federal law, and the exchange that resulted from that, that has been a disastrous rollout. And what the lieutenant governor can also do is make sure that the plan that comes out is a good plan, and I think I'll be an effective watchdog in making sure that happens, and then going around Vermont and talking to Vermonters about it.
Of course, we're all waiting with anticipation to find out what the funding mechanism that's going to be proposed in January. Dean, let me start this question on your end here. In terms of constructing the way to have this paid for, what would be the goal that you would have?
Yeah, that's a good question, Mark. The goal is very straightforward. In fact, I laid this out quite specifically when I wrote one of the first single-payer bills in the Vermont legislature, which was back in the mid-90s. The basic principle is very straightforward, and we all actually know what's going to be involved in the plan. We don't know the exact numbers yet, and also the administration has consultants doing economic studies to figure out what will have the least negative effects on any particular sector. And the basic principle is simply that we have flow of money coming now. When I was in the legislature, we were concerned that we were passing the $1.5 billion point in Vermont healthcare spending. Now we're over $5 billion a year. All of that money came out of Vermonters. It all came out of Vermonters' pockets. And if we don't do something, it's going to accelerate more. We're going to have really an unaffordable situation for our entire economy, our businesses, our employees. And so what you need to do now is take the portion of that $5 billion we're spending now, which Vermonters are paying directly out of pocket and in health care premiums, Vermonters and employers, and replace that with our own taxes. And what those taxes are going to be is going to be a mixture of payroll taxes and income taxes. We're going to end up spending less. That's the bottom line. The bottom line is the bottom line. And it's important that we spend less because we can't afford what's been going on. And the principle is simply that you want to match the flows that we have now as closely as you can with the flows from these taxes in the short term. And then over the long term, you can transition that to where we would rather be. Obviously, having payroll taxes pay for anything is a bad idea. It's regressive. It discourages employment. But that's where the money is coming from now. Your typical employer is paying on average about 15% of salaries to health care costs.
Okay,
some more, some less.
All right, going to interrupt you there. Phil, I know you've been a skeptic of the single payer, but you're going to be in a position, if reelected, to try to influence what that plan might be. So what would your goal be in this?
Well, I've heard the term free an awful lot this morning already, and giving the businesses freedom in terms of their future and being able to grow and so forth, not having this burden. But I've been in business for 30 years. I've covered insurance. I've gone through all the peaks and valleys of being in business in Vermont. And when I hear about healthcare and free, I think there's nothing free about healthcare. There's nothing free about anything. Somebody has to pay the bill. And when I hear about lifting the burden off from employers, I'm a skeptic because it depends on what the plan looks like, what's covered. What I envision is if there's a basic plan that is developed and it doesn't meet expectations of employees, that there's going to be supplemental insurance. Employers are always going to be in the game if that's the case. So details really matter. It really does matter what the plan looks like, how much it's going to cost, who's going to pay for it, and how are we going to compete? We're not on an island here in Vermont. We have to compete with our neighbors. We have to compete with other states. And when people travel out of state, or people are employed out of state, or people that aren't part of Vermont, who pays what? And those details really do matter. And I don't think we can gloss over that. I think that we have to have all of that information and for us to make an informed decision about whether this is good for Vermont in its future. And again, I think we're very small. Our demographics are shifting. We're a state, we haven't been growing. We're a state of 620,000 people. We're losing our youth, 25 to 45. We've lost 30,000 people out of that category alone. And we need to concentrate on that and bring that back so that we can be stronger in the future.
Dean, are you leaping before you look here? I mean, how can you sign on to something where you don't know the details, as Phil suggests?
Well, that's why we need a lieutenant governor who's worked on such details before and who's going to be a good watchdog and working on the details now. It's decades too late to say we don't know what we want to do. The legislature already decided we're going to go to single payer in 2017. That's a decision that's already been made by a prior legislature. Now it is a matter of working out the details, and I'm very eager to do that in conjunction with the administration. And I will also be critical if there's parts of it that I don't think are going to work very well. It is about cost, and it is about details, and it's not just a matter of saying, well, I'm going to be skeptical forever. We're actually going to have to work on these and get it done in the next biennium.
What's the other option?
Well, as I said before, I think utilizing the exchange that's being developed right now is an option. I think utilizing we spent $70 million on this rollout, this exchange that we've developed so far, and it's not working. New Hampshire spent $8 million. $8 million took one right off the shelf from the federal exchange. Utilize that. You can make changes. You can. I've been on it myself. You can find out how much it would cost, and it works. But again, we're such a small population. If we can work with our neighbors, maybe a Northeast coalition of some sort, increase competition, expand the exchange so there's more choices, so that you can have your choice of doctors, you can have your choice of plans. Everyone is a little bit different, and every situation is different. I think that that's the first step. And when I think about again these details, and I know there are many who say, well, the lieutenant governor can do thus and so. Well, I'm a Republican in a democratically controlled Senate, House, administration. I mean, you look down through the line. Our congressional delegation is dominated by the Democrats, the administration, the governor's office, the auditor, the
treasurer. So you're powerless?
Well, I'm just saying, if it's such a great, it's a good idea, why haven't we done it? Why haven't we have all the power there now. It's not like I'm the one that can then move it forward. I think they have all the numbers, all the people in order to do it and to give us the details that we need. There are a number of exit ramps for this legislation. I know it's been said that we're moving forward with this. It's going to be implemented. But there's a few exit ramps along the way, and they have to meet certain expectations in order to make sure it's affordable. And it makes sure it makes sense for Vermont. And I think being a skeptic is a good thing. I think somebody needs to bring up some of these issues so that we make sure we don't leap into something that is going to be detrimental to Vermont. And maybe it's a good thing. But again, those details matter, and we deserve to know what it looks like before we move forward.
Dean, how would single payer keep costs under control?
It's the only way to keep costs under control, because I prefer the term comprehensive, because it's where you're actually focused in one area of having control over the whole balloon of healthcare spending. What we've done in the past is say, oh, well, we'll crack down on hospital costs here, and then costs get shifted elsewhere. We'll cover seniors. And then costs get shifted to everyone else. We'll cover everyone through age of 17 under Dr. Dinosaur, and then costs get shifted elsewhere. The only way to do it is to say, we're going to be Vermonters. We're 626,000 people. We're the size of a very large corporation. Any corporation that size is going to be self-insuring. They're not going to waste money giving money to insurance companies. They're going to say, actuarially, we're going to have a certain number of bad gallbladders, a certain number of bad spleens. We can, for that number of people, we can know what the costs are going to be, statistically. And plus, we're going to buy drugs for everyone in the state. We're going to go out and negotiate as a pool of 626,000 to buy pharmaceuticals at a better price than the federal government can get them for now, because the federal government passed laws saying that they couldn't negotiate prices. So once you get control over all the costs, you can actually control costs in a way that you have no control over whatsoever. Now, if we joined the federal exchange, not only would we have no control over costs, but we would lose at least 100 standards that we've set over the years, Democrats, Republicans, progressives, over the years, for health care provision in Vermont, and we would simply lose them by going to the federal exchange. That's really not an option. But down the road, what's really exciting about health care reform is once we have a comprehensive system, down the road, we can tailor incentives to get the providers we need. We have too many specialists driving up costs. We can have more nurses trained. And we can really tailor it to the Vermont needs. And over time, costs will be controlled even better.
You want to respond to that, Phil?
Well, once again, I think one things we're missing is that we're causing a lot of the cost to be driven. You know, we look at the other side. We look at how we're going to pay for it. We're looking for savings there, which is fine. Efficiencies are great in any business or healthcare. I applaud the Green Mountain Care Board for all the work they've done so far. They're doing a good job in trying to control some of those costs and look forward. But, you know, what we're really looking at is how do we prevent things from happening? Prevention is something that we're not talking enough about. When you look yourself in the mirror, that's some of our cost driver, that we're causing the utilization of health care. So we have a responsibility to ourselves. There has to be some way that we take responsibility and try to take better care of ourselves so that we don't drive those costs further. So in anything that we do, whether it's single payer or the exchange or anything we do in the future in terms of health care, that has to be a major part, a major piece of prevention.
I'm interested to hear you express confidence in the Green Mountain Care Board. You actually expressed some skepticism about that, and you wrote an op-ed piece. And one of your concerns about going to single payer was putting the benefit selection and how this was all going to be done in the hands of five people. So why are you confident now with the Green Mountain Care Board doing what they're doing today?
Well, what they're doing today, they're not working on single payer as much as some people might think. I think what they've been doing, spending an incredible amount of time, is working with hospitals and trying to reduce costs, not just capping the cost, but helping them find different ways for us to be more efficient and to cut those costs together instead of just automatically saying we're not going to allow you to do thus and so, working with the hospitals. I went to a couple of the public hearings in the last couple of weeks. I'd never been to one, and I thought it was important that actually see what type of public information is out there. Listen to some of their testimony from the hospitals, and it was beneficial. I mean, they're talking about some of the things, the prevention issues that should be part of the global picture, and I think that it's exciting. And again, I may have been critical of the Green Mountain Care Board in respect to single payer, but in respect to what they're doing right now in terms of trying to really get a handle on health care costs, I applaud their efforts.
Team, what do you think about the Green Mountain Care Board? And if they're doing such a great job controlling costs, why make this big move to a different system?
Well, the Green Mountain Care Board is doing a great job, and I'm a big supporter of Al Gobay, the chair of the board. However, they do not have the ability to really control costs at this point because we don't have the single-payer system yet. So they're doing the best with what they did. They took over from the Hospital Data Council that put pressure downward on hospital budgets, but that's just a tiny, tiny piece of the overall picture. The really exciting thing, one of the more exciting things about the future of having a comprehensive plan is that we will be able to do real cost cutting in terms of things like prevention. We have a blueprint for health in this state that is a tremendous plan for prevention and cutting costs in the future. We have never had a comprehensive way of implementing it, though. And once we have the single payer system, that will be integrated not only with the provider incentives I mentioned, but with the entire blueprint of health, to have programs in place that can really cut costs. I'll give you one example. A plan for a statewide plan for managing chronic heart failure. If you avoid a rehospitalization for someone with a chronic condition, that's a tremendous cost savings. And the blueprint calls for a plan like that, and it's a very workable, practical plan. Once we have the single payer system in place, we'll be able to implement that in a more thoroughgoing statewide way.
If you're just tuning in, we're broadcasting live this morning from the Tunbridge World's Fair, and we're having a debate between the Lieutenant Governor candidates, Phil Scott, the Republican, Dean Corin, the Progressive Democrat. We'll take a short commercial break. We'll be back for more discussion right after this.
Hi, folks. Ruben from RB Technologies here again. Can you believe it? RB Tech is celebrating our 17th year in business. We're incredibly thankful for our continued growth and success, and we believe strongly in giving back to the community and our customers. And while everyone at RB Tech fully understands the critical nature of of the systems we support, we're careful not to take ourselves too seriously. So each fall, we throw an open house that we call Revenge on Technology. For Revenge on Tech 3.0, we'll be flipping burgers from Tangletown Farm and listening to tunes by Abby Jenny and Hot Diggity. Resource will be here collecting equipment for their essential goods program, where it'll be rebuilt and repurposed. In addition, we'll have a free collection box set up for the less usable stuff. So come on out to our headquarters in East Montpelier Friday, September 19th, beginning at 3 o'clock, and help us celebrate. As always, thanks for listening, and our deepest thanks for 17 years of trust in the RB Tech team.
RB Technologies. Call them at 223-4448 or 24-7 at rbtechvt.com. That's rbtechvt.com. RB Technologies. Efficiency through technology.
Hi, this is Rich Harvey from Montpelier Pharmacy and Waterbury Pharmacy. The leaves are turning and the nights are cooler. For me, this means that I need to plan for the flu season. Although the flu season doesn't usually peak in Vermont until January, everyone should be thinking of getting a flu shot. The flu affects everyone, but hits people with chronic medical conditions and the young and old hardest. More than 30,000 people will die from the flu this year. The flu shot is very safe. Because it's not a live vaccine, you can't get the flu from the flu shot. We'll be offering preservative-free flu shots regularly from October through January. Most insurances cover the flu shot. If you're a business owner and want to protect your employees, give us a call. We'll send over a team to vaccinate your employees, and we'll bill you later. So protect yourself, your family, and your employees, and get a flu shot. Give us a call with any questions. Montpelier Pharmacy, 223-4633. Waterbury Pharmacy, 244-7701. Locally owned and independent. Thank you.
802cars.com represents the top three selling brands in Vermont, just off exit 7 of I-89. 802 Toyota sells Vermont's number one brand. Twin City Subaru sells Vermont's unofficial state car. 802 Honda sells Vermont's number three brand. This is Dave Birmingham, chief cook and dog walker. When you come to any of our dealerships, you'll be able to find the vehicle you want at the price you want. 802cars.com offers what no other dealer can. One-stop shopping for Vermont's top three brands, all just off the interstate. We'll help you find the right vehicle that fits your budget. Don't forget, we're the largest seller of certified used cars in Vermont because we all know the best new cars make the best used cars too. So click on 802cars.com for information on all our great products. Call 229-9117 and speak to one of our low-key product specialists. Drive I-89 to exit 7. We're just a minute off the interstate. 802 Toyota, Twin City Subaru, and 802 Honda. Driving to be Vermont's number one auto solution.
We're back. We're broadcasting live this morning from the Tunbridge World's Fair, and we're having a debate between the candidates in the lieutenant governor's race. Again, we apologize. Not able to take your phone calls this morning, but I appreciate all the questions that I got throughout the course of the week. They were very helpful. Let's talk a little bit about property taxes, and I know people are very interested to hear your thoughts on how to try to get the costs of school spending under control. Let's start with you, Phil. What are you going to do?
Well, again, it's what we haven't done for a number of years. I think I was very disappointed in the legislature in the last session. There was a measure taken up in the last, really, the final hour of the legislature in terms of trying to have something that they could hang their hat on in terms of trying to deal with property tax and education revenue reform and so forth. So we didn't do it. And, you know, it seems like every election we say we have to get property tax reform. We have to deal with this, and we have to cut costs, and we never do. And that's because it's very difficult. And when we think about healthcare, there's a lot of similarities when we talk about hospitals and cutting and trying to utilize what we have for infrastructure. It's the same way with our schools. We're going to, in business, when you have high costs and you have decreasing revenues, you have to cut your overhead. And I'm afraid that we're going to have to do some of the same things. And maybe it's new technology. Maybe it's trying to do things differently in the future. But we really have to look at the operating costs in order to make a big enough dent, and that may mean closing some of the smaller schools. And I know that's very, very difficult because everyone talks about wanting to address property taxes and reduce the costs of schools and education until it comes to their own schools. And that's what's very, very difficult about this. We're all very intimate. We're all community-minded. We like our schools. We like our communities. And we don't want things to change. We just want the costs to go down. And unfortunately, I don't think we can have both. But we have to address this. We have to, as a legislature, to address the affordability issues that we're facing today to keep people here and increase prosperity for all of Vermont.
What's an effective way to close schools? How do you do it?
Well, I think you're going to have to look at a case-by-case basis. You can't, it's not a broad brush. It's not saying any schools with less than 20 kids, they have to close. I think it's a case-by-case basis. You know, you look back about, I grew up, of course, in Barrie, but I spent an awful lot of time in Lake Elmore growing up. They have a one-room school there. But they did things a little bit differently. They would have their one-room school would have grades kindergarten through six or seven, depending on how many kids there are. So their class wouldn't class sizes might reduce. They also might have kids going to Morrisville from third grade on, depending on how many students. So their overall student population didn't increase or decrease. It's just the grades did. And so there may be some looking backwards again about how we did things in the past might be beneficial. But again, addressing the operating costs, the overhead costs, that's the only place we can go.
What are your thoughts on controlling school costs, Dean?
Well, I think that there is general agreement that the property tax is a major problem. It's been, from the beginning of my political career, one of the most concerning things to me. And there are a number of things going on. One is that with the Brigham decision, it was decided by the Supreme Court that school funding was unfair for students around the state. This has been an issue for over 100 years, but since Act 60, we made it a lot fairer for students around the state. What we didn't do is make it fairer for taxpayers around the state by continuing our reliance on the property tax, which has gone up and up and up over the last three decades, while marginal tax rates on the wealthiest have gone down significantly over the same period of time. What's happened is that the middle class has become entirely squeezed, and that's why so many people feel like they are really burdened by the property tax, because they are. We added income sensitivity also to help the poorest people in the state of Vermont, and even some that are not quite so poor. But the fact of the matter is that all that leaves is for the middle class to be squeezed. The very wealthiest people, even in a fabulously valuable home, tend to pay a lot less of their income for property taxes for schools. Now, one of the reasons that school prices, that school costs are going up so much is health care. It's one of the few uncontrolled costs that that schools have. Other than that, virtually every school board I know talks most of the time they're together. They're talking about where they're going to cut, and that's what's going on. So I don't think that the proposal to force consolidation around the state is a good idea. For one thing, it has not been shown that it would actually control any costs. For another thing, you have most legislators constantly talking about local control, but then when push comes to shove, local control tends to disappear. But some of us really believe in local control. And in those cases where there is a perceived benefit on a local level of consolidation and the state can provide some technical assistance, some financial assistance to help localities who want to do that, that's great. But a forced program, I think, is contrary to what we want to do and hasn't been shown to be effective.
I heard you say that you don't think wealthier people are paying as fair a share as other people. How would you get at that?
I think the simplest way, given the structures that we have now, has been a proposal that has been floated around towards the end of the last biennium, which is simply to increase the level of income sensitivity, that program, to basically cover everyone. Because all that structure is already there. The property tax is very complex. It's very inefficient to administer. It costs the state a lot to administer it. It costs towns a lot to administer it. But we do have the income sensitivity portion. And one of the proposals I think you'll see in the next biennium is to simply expand that. And that'll make it more fair for all taxpayers.
If you're just tuning in, we're broadcasting live this morning from the Tunbridge World's Fair. We have the candidates for Lieutenant Governor. Phil Scott is the incumbent Republican. Dean Corin is running as a progressive and Democrat. I want to turn our discussion here to a couple of environmental issues. I know you two disagree on the issue of wind power. Dean, let me start with you. In fact, I don't think I've heard anybody talk about the beauty of windmills quite as extensively as I've heard you talk about it.
Right.
Talk about wind power for us.
Right. It's funny because I think I might have mentioned to you that when I was at NYU doing research, we did some testing on the ugliest wind turbine in the world. And that was installed on top of a building in a historic district in New York. And it's a really unusual circumstance. But when it came time to take that hideous, hideous wind turbine away, everybody in the neighborhood said, "Where are you taking our wind turbine?" The fact of the matter is studies show that people who live closer to them like them better than people who don't. The imagined horrors of living near wind turbines is great, but the reality is very different. The problem that we have in Vermont now, I believe, is because the past two administrations prior to the current one, which has set some very good renewable energy standards in conjunction with the legislature, not just the administration, but the prior two administrations were both very anti-wind, and that not only prevented wind turbines from being built in Vermont, it prevented us from having a good dialogue around the state as to where we would build wind turbines and where we would not allow them to be built. And so when you talk about turbines going up on ridge lines, one imagines that they'll go up on every ridge line. And of course, we have ridge lines in Vermont, many, that need to be protected in perpetuity from any development whatsoever. And what we should have done 20 years ago is come up with a map of the wind resource and all the other resources we have, natural and social and cultural, and created a map of where wind development could take place and where it could never take place. And we failed to do that, which really set us back in terms of the whole discussion. So instead, what you have, of course, is ad hoc proposals, proposal here from a developer, proposal there, which need to be dealt with by the Public Service Board. And then everybody is always back on their heels addressing proposals, whereas planning, something that our society is not that great at, but we really need to try harder on, planning is something that we should have done. So I think there is a mix of where we can and where we cannot do wind turbines. And in terms of the aesthetics, I have been out kayaking with my wife on Arrowhead Mountain Lake, and the view of the reeds rising from the water, and then in the distance, the wind turbines on Georgia Mountain is a very beautiful sight.
Phil?
First of all, I'm a big proponent of renewable energy. I think that the more we can take care of ourselves, the more we could become independent, self-reliant, is very important to us as a society, not just here in Vermont, but all across the nation. So I've always been a big supporter. In fact, when I was at UVM, I built some wind turbine blades for a wind turbine that was flown over UVM for a number of years. In fact, David Blittersdorf was the one that did the motor power, and we built the blades for it. So for myself, yesterday, I was at the ribbon cutting for a solar panel in the town of Craftsbury, and I'm not sure that they were all as enthusiastic about wind power as some in Vermont, because they've had to see some of it from their backyards. But the solar panels, I'm increasingly optimistic about the changes that we've made in technology in terms of solar in particular, because they are producing more and more with a smaller amount of footprint. They're going to be able to use in Craftsbury one-third of, with this one solar tracker, one-third of their power is going to be utilized by this this device for their town garage and as well as their town offices. So that's a great step in the right direction.
But back on the wind, didn't you, you were in favor of the moratorium for 2 years?
Absolutely. When I was in favor of the first phase of wind, I thought that, again, that we owed it to ourselves to move forward on that. But then again, after seeing what I saw, I was biking up in the Northeast Kingdom when they were first erected, and I was taken aback a bit by the size and the magnitude of these wind turbines. And after talking with many people in the Northeast Kingdom that have are counting on tourism and so forth, I thought, we should step back here. We've done this first phase. We should step back a bit and make sure this makes sense from a number of different standpoints. Does it make sense financially? Are we getting are we getting back what we put into it? Do they make sense in our future? And again, from an infrastructure standpoint, we have to distribute the power as well. So it's not just about putting the turbines on top of our ridge lines. It's about how do we get the power distributed from there to the rest of Vermont or wherever it's going. So there are a number of details that we need to at least consider. And I thought, what an opportunity to at least take a step back, think about this, get the data, and make sure that this is right for Vermont.
This is FM 96.1 WDEV Warren, broadcasting from the top of Sugar Bush and AM 550 WDEV Waterbury Montpelier and WLVB Morrisville. Vermont Gas is looking to extend a pipeline down the western part of the state, in fact, going even underneath Lake Champlain. Phil, do you support this Vermont Gas Line extension?
I support. I think this is a step in the right direction in terms of providing a more economical power source and heating source for Vermonters. And again, I talk a lot about the affordability of Vermont, and we need to do something in terms of at least a bridge towards what our future is going to be in terms of power and infrastructure. So I'm supportive thus far. I think that having the Public Service Board take another look, that's fine. I think that's good. We need to be careful. There are skeptics there, and that's fine too. I've been a skeptic myself on a number of different issues. So making sure we get it right is important. And so I'm in favor, especially for those folks in the Rutland area that are really looking forward to having a source of energy that is more cost effective for them.
Dean, do you support this project?
Well, here's an area where I think I could be called a skeptic. As you know, in my day job, I do energy, particularly renewable energy, but we deal with all the industrial aspects of energy. And I did ask the, I did put out a press release hoping that the Supreme Court would remand the case back to the Public Service Board. I thought it was extraordinary that the board asked for the case back so that they could revisit not only phases two and three, but phase one of the gas pipeline. I don't think all the economics are shown. The legislators, both the reps and senators representing Addison County and that area, are highly skeptical of the project, and they raised a number of really important issues about the economics and the notion that since that pipeline was originally proposed, a lot of things have changed in terms of the financing and in terms of the alternative technologies. And the question of whether the gas pipeline is actually a bridge to the future would have been a much clearer question 20 or 30 years ago, when it definitely would have been. But at this point, to build an infrastructure with a very expensive infrastructure, $100 million, with a 70-year lifespan, when we need to be getting rid of fossil fuels long before that, it's very questionable whether it's a bridge anymore. I think it's time, it has may well have passed, and we should be focused on those solar and other renewable technologies.
I want to talk about children. There have been some terrible tragedies in Vermont in the past few months, including a couple of children who are under supervision of the state of Vermont. is the state of Vermont doing a good enough job to protect children, and was Governor Shumlin right to fire Doug Racine? Dean, let me start with you.
Well, I have no idea whether the governor was right to fire Doug Racine, or if, in fact, he did fire Doug Racine. I have known.
Well, he did. Doug said he did, so that's clear.
Okay, we'll take his word for it. I have known over the years several people who've worked in that capacity. Bill Young, back in the 90s, through Dave Iacovone. And I'm always amazed that Vermont has the resources, the human resources, to have these extraordinary public servants working in those roles, and yet these problems persist. And I do not claim to be an expert in how to deal with these problems, but we do need to attract the kinds of people who have been working in this area to do that. Whether there are legislative solutions in terms of the privacy concerns, you know, DCF is always bound to hold this information confidential while people are free to say whatever they want in the press. So it's a very tough area, and I support the people who get involved in those kind of social services and admire them greatly, and would be extremely happy to hear any proposed solutions to how these things won't keep coming up. But they have for a very, very long time.
But answer my question. Do you think the state today is doing a good enough job to protect children?
I really don't have the information to evaluate that, because I'm not an insider in those areas. But obviously, it's of great concern to every Vermonter.
Phil?
Well, I go back to the firing of Doug Racine first. I served when I first was in office as a senator. Doug Racine was lieutenant governor at the time. I got to know him then. Then he served as a senator, so I served with him in that capacity as well. And he's a really honorable person, knowledgeable, cares deeply about the issues that he went on to become secretary of. And we don't agree philosophically, but he's an honorable guy, and I think a lot of them. I don't think, and I've been in business for, 30 years. I've had to fire a few people myself. It's not an easy job, but that's, in my estimation, in my view, that wasn't the way to do it. And you do it face-to-face. If you have an issue with somebody, you try and work with them. And if it's true that they hadn't met for a year before, I think that that's mismanagement in some respects. I think that you have a team, you build a team, you get consensus, and if you have a problem, you try and work those things out long before you have to fire somebody. In terms of whether the DCF is doing a good job or not, there's a lot of good folks there, and we're doing and they're doing the best they can. Obviously, we should be doing better, and maybe it's more resources. I don't know. But it all reflects, I think, upon the challenges we face with the crisis of affordability in Vermont. There are so many stresses on families, and so many stresses on individuals. And I think that having a better economy, having us prosper more, would have a beneficial effect on that as well.
Let's talk about marijuana. The state's looking at, is studying whether or not to legalize it. Phil, would you be in favor of legalizing marijuana?
I think we need to step back and look at Colorado, look at Washington, and let them lead on this issue. And let's see what the effects of their change in legislation has on them. Before we move forward, I was in favor of decriminalization of marijuana because I didn't think it should hang over someone's head forever. But I'm increasingly I'm skeptical, I guess. Again, I use that word a lot, but I'm worried, I guess, about all that I've seen with all different types of things. We have our DUI laws in Vermont. We're able to take and analyze whether a driver is impaired by their blood alcohol limit. And we aren't going to be able to do that with pot. And so until we're able to get a measurement of some way of impairment, I think there are a lot more questions that need to be answered before we move forward on that front.
Dean?
Well, the bottom line is I think it's inevitable. I'm supportive of it. I think that I want to be extremely careful as to how we do it. There may be a lot of details to work out. But basically, we need to regularize the use of marijuana the way alcohol has been somewhat regularized, and making it a criminal situation and having a whole criminal chain of delivery of something that people want and is arguably less harmful than the alcohol that people regularly use. I think this is inevitable. As I say, I do want us to be very careful. We already do have the examples of Colorado and Washington to look at, and we will be looking at them as we move forward on this.
Another environmental question. We continue to have significant algae blooms in Lake Champlain. There's been well over $100 million spent. Seems as though, I hate to use the term, but kind of treading water in terms of fighting this. Dean, what would you do about it?
Well, I think it's something that we do have to deal with. There's just no question about it. Even the feds are getting on our case for having had such poor performance in terms of cleaning up the lake, and it's actually getting worse. Of course, that's combined with global warming and the fact that the phosphorus combined with the warmer temperatures makes the algal blooms even worse than they have been. I don't know why it has taken us so long to do this. We have invested money. We do need to support our agricultural community and help them get this problem done. I imagine that there are a lot of ways that we could do it that are not costly. And it's simply something that there's another area where we do not have an option to not improve this situation.
Phil?
I was in St. Albans this past week speaking to some community leaders, and they brought up this issue, and it's very near and dear to their hearts with St. Albans Bay, and they're demanding that we do something, and they're very, of course, encouraged about the $45 million that was announced last week, and I don't have the details on how that's going to be enacted and how we're going to utilize those dollars, but what they were afraid of was that more of the agricultural community invested in this. I think it's important, and I think that they're engaged now more so than ever, and that's going to go a long ways towards the cleanup in the future. But again, what they'd like to see in St. Albans is they want to see the algae gone now. And so from a short-term standpoint, whether it means, and they said that you don't have to reinvent the wheel. There are other areas across the nation that have these issues, and they've been able to solve them. They've been able to clean up the algae. So I think it's a two-tier effect. And they suggested that we bring a team together. Maybe it's like the Green Mountain Care Board of some sort, and have maybe 6 to 12 people that oversee this money to make sure that it's utilized effectively and put towards the cleanup, not just for studies.
Agricultural best practices, as they're called, are now voluntary. Dave Mears, the head of the Department of Environmental Conservation, seems to be at odds with the Agriculture Secretary. Mr. Mears would like those to become mandatory. Would you support them being mandatory, Phil?
Well, again, I think that you by forcing a heavy hand doesn't always get you the results you need either. There is a balancing act here. Agriculture is very important to the state. It's something that is part of our heritage. It's the backbone of the state, and so we need to protect that. At the same time, I think there are ways to bring change and bring new practices together. I was encouraged. I met with some folks from New York that have a new, it's more of a silt fence that they were trying to encourage the state to use that was more effective. But it also, as I was reading the material and talking with them, it's a real step forward in trying to reduce the amount of phosphorus that could get through this type of silt barrier. and very cost effective. And it's something that that I'm going to have them come back and meet with the Secretary of Agriculture as well as Commissioner Mears to see if this is an approach that may be very, very low cost in terms of the overall picture and may be beneficial for our future.
Dean, best practices, should they be mandatory or continue to be voluntary?
I think there could be a level of mandatory requirement that it's based on the level of effort that's been put in. For those that are trying, that it's just a very challenging thing and are moving forward, that's one thing. And for those who are not moving forward, that would be something else where you may need to step in. But I can guarantee you that if the people of Vermont are willing to support me in my candidacy for lieutenant governor, when I am lieutenant governor, you will see on my website a focus on this issue and working on it with Deb Markowitz and others to get this environmental job done and work with the agricultural community in a really constructive way and a collaborative way to make sure that we're not worse off 2 years from now than we have been, because it's really an unacceptable situation.
We're almost out of time here. I want to take our last couple of minutes here and give you each an opportunity to complete the following sentence for us. In the next 2 years, if you're elected lieutenant governor, you're going to pledge to these fine folks watching here and listening on the radio that you're going to do what? Dean Corn, start us off.
Well, as I have said from the beginning, I'm going to work very, very hard on the details and of health care and make sure that we have a reasonably sustainable plan for carrying forward our single-payer system so that everybody in Vermont is covered for health care and doesn't have that to worry about when they're trying to worry about all the other aspects of life, including affordability of everything that they pay for. That's something that you're going to see done. I'm also going to be working on making sure that we really do address job development and economic development in the era of climate change in a way that not only gets our renewable energy sources expanded greatly, but also creates a business center in Vermont for providing those kinds of services and technologies throughout the world. I think it's a great growth potential for us. And in addition to playing to our other strengths, value-added agriculture and so many other areas and some of the high-tech areas that we're growing, whether it's the gaming industry or others, we'll focus on those and have bottom-up Vermont-grown businesses that are going to stay here as they grow and create the number of jobs we need.
Phil?
I think the Vermonters will see the same thing that they've seen in the past with my leadership over the last 14 years, a collaborative effort to bring consensus, to bring people together, to reach across party lines and really build a team, get on the same page in terms of trying to move Vermont forward in terms of prosperity. Again, with all the folks I've talked to across the state, the common theme is this crisis we face, the affordability issues, the property taxes that are too high, and they're afraid, and they need some help, and they need leadership that will bring them forward and bring them to a level that they deserve. So I've always been the type of leader that doesn't necessarily get up on a soapbox and scream about what I've done. But those that know me know that I work very hard. I have an open door policy. I listen and I bring people together in order to arrive at consensus. I think that in terms of the agenda that we face in the next 2 years, bringing the growth of the economy to the forefront is something that will be beneficial to all. So I am going to continue in my efforts to make sure that that's our highest priority, as opposed to the last few years, where in the last session we had over 1,000 bills introduced. About 20 of those had any positive effect on the economy. And out of the 20 that had a positive effect on the economy, only one or two pass, and that's not good enough.
Phil Scott is the Republican candidate for lieutenant governor. He's the incumbent. Dean Corn is running as a progressive and a Democrat. I want to thank you both for joining us. Here, please take a bag of Vermont Coffee Company coffee with you.
Oh,
probably would have been nice if I could have brewed some up for you. You could have at least held on to the warm package. Again,
thank you very much for joining us.
I want to thank you all for joining us here, too. Thank you all, folks, here. And thank you all to those. Yes, you can give these folks a nice round of applause. And well, thank you all, too, for those of you listening on the radio, our friends on WLVB joining us as well this morning from Morrisville, in addition to our broadcaster on WDEV AM and FM. We'll take a short commercial break. We'll be back right after these important announcements. Victoria Jones will be joining us next.
We are high performance, low pressure. Walker Volkswagen on the Barrymont-Pilliar Road is celebrating its grand reopening, and you are invited. We have finished our dealership's renovation and expansion project and are excited to share our passion for Volkswagen with you. We are so excited that we are giving away a new Volkswagen Beetle. I told you, we are seriously celebrating. Take advantage of Walker Volkswagen's grand reopening celebration with our deeply discounted upfront pricing that eliminates all the gimmicks and stressful negotiations in buying your next car. When combined with 0% financing on every 2014 Volkswagen model, you can save thousands of dollars. Join in Walker Volkswagen's grand reopening celebration on the Barrymont Pilliar Road. See how you can be driving an affordable German-engineered, European-styled Volkswagen. Stop by, call, or click walkervt.com to see why we are Vermont's source for everything Volkswagen. Oh, and remember to ask us about the Volkswagen Beetle giveaway.
Tired of grocery shopping at huge supermarkets with no personality? This is Tom Mihuron, and I invite you to shop our well-stocked, right-sized family market in Waitsfield. Custom-cut meats, fresh seafood and produce, gourmet cheeses, regular and organic groceries, and over 1,000 wines. Come and see Jeff and Bill in the meat department, Tana and produce, Gary in seafood, Nate in the deli, or Nancy and Liz in our incredible wine department. Family-run for over 70 years. Mihuron Supermarket, Village Square Shopping Center in Waitsfield.
I love Hunger Mountain Food Co-op because we at Riverside Farm love growing real organic food for real people. I'm Bruce Kaufman from Riverside Farm in East Hardwick, and I've been a vendor at Hunger Mountain Co-op since 1987.
For the latest weather forecast, call the WDEV Weather Phone, 800-585-1211 or 244-1172. The WDEV Weather Phone, sponsored by Twin City Subaru on the Berlin Mall Road. Stop in today and let one of the gurus introduce you to Vermont's unofficial state car.
Looking for a loan for your Vermont business, childcare, or nonprofit organization? Look at the Vermont Community Loan Fund. Because at the Vermont Community Loan Fund, we lend to Vermont businesses and nonprofits, even if the bank says you're not quite ready for a loan. At the Vermont Community Loan Fund, we focus on people, not profits. We'll work closely with you before and after you get your loan to make sure you get what you need to succeed. The Vermont Community Loan Fund makes loans to early stage companies and established businesses ready to take the next step. We lend to farms and food producers, high-tech businesses, manufacturers, retailers, childcare businesses, affordable housing developers, service providers, and other nonprofit organizations.